This is Line One, Your Health Connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. Those of you who are my age and are male need to be getting, or thinking at least, about getting your prostate screened. And there, this week, there's going to be some free prostate screening being done by the Alaska Urological Associates and Alaska Regional Hospital. This evening from 4 to 8, and Tuesday evening from 4 to 8, and Thursday evening from 4 to 8 at the office of the Alaska Urological Associates, 1200 Airport Heights, Suite 101. They will be doing prostate screens, and you can get your prostate-specific antigen level drawn as well. The phone number I have here is 276-1474. I remember when I called it, it wasn't quite the right number. So if that doesn't work, look up Alaska Urological Associates. You actually do not have to have an appointment. Just go to the Plaza Building, Alaska Regional Hospital, Suite 101. And this evening, if you'd like to, between 4 and 8, or tomorrow or Thursday between 4 and 8. Before I introduce my guest, I'd like to make just comment on a recent study that was done. Sometimes we still hear people wondering, should there be a law to protect us? Should we have seatbelts and so forth? And in Ontario, Canada, they asked the question, should we be using bicycle helmets to help protect people? And they passed a law, and they've now looked back at the mortality rates in children between 1 and 15 in a 10-year period, 1991 to 2002. And there was a 52% decrease in mortality related to bicycles in that age group. At the same time, they looked back over the same period of time in individuals over 18 years of age to see what that mortality rate was. Since the law did not affect people over 18, there was no change. So this was a kind of simple study, but also had kind of its own control group, which answers the question, should you be doing it or not? I guess we could argue somewhat philosophically that maybe we still shouldn't have to tell people or enforce the idea that you ought to try to protect yourself. But in this particular situation, it seems very, very clear that a significant number of adults died who otherwise would not have died, perhaps if they'd been wearing a helmet. So we're interviewing a neurologist today, and it's reasonable, and I'm sure he'd agree, you want to protect your noggin out there as much as you possibly can. So my guest today is Dr. Frank Ellenson. He's a neurologist. He's been with us in Anchorage for a little over a year after doing his medical school training in Detroit at Wayne State, and then all of his residency training, including neurology at Oregon Health Sciences program in Portland, Oregon. Dr. Ellenson, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
And welcome to Anchorage.
Glad to be here.
We are going to talk about Parkinson's disease today. So those of you who are listening who have questions about Parkinson's disease, what it is, how it manifests itself, how do you diagnose it, how you treat it, this is the time to think about giving us a call. In Anchorage at 550-8433, I'll just give you that number right up front. That's the number you can call if you have questions. We're going to go over the illness. We're going to talk about how it presents. We're going to talk about treatment. So you may want to just hang on also. But if you have questions about what you hear, give us a call. Frank, let's just start with the basics. What do we mean when we say Parkinson's disease? What does that mean to you?
Sure. Parkinson's disease is a constellation of symptoms usually manifesting in gait problems, walking problems. Most people also have tremoring, usually on just one side of their body. Stiffness. It can also be associated with pain, falling due to the walking problems, hypotension, loss of blood pressure, which might cause someone to pass out, and other symptoms that are fairly common can include urinary changes, erectile dysfunction, depression, and even an increased risk in memory impairment or dementia.
As a neurologist, what is your experience and what brings people in to see you? What are the symptoms that you see? And then I'd just like to ask, how long have those usually been there before
sure.
somebody gets a little worried enough?
It kind of depends on the patient. Sometimes I see patients and they say, my doctor told me to come here.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, they're very acutely aware of the tremoring and the associated problems like holding objects. Handwriting tends to deteriorate, getting smaller and smaller, sometimes to the point of illegibility. But usually when people have a tremor and trouble walking, those are the things that really are obvious to them. Later, after they've started treatment, they may notice that some muscle cramps or soreness in their neck or back may have been alleviated, and that could have been related to Parkinson's disease early on. I think you also asked how long have things been going on usually before patients are aware of it or before right. they come to see me. Usually, patients are symptomatic for months or years before they see a neurologist. Probably the pathogenesis or the development of the disease has been going on for many years prior to that.
One of the things that I just gave a talk at a conference, and we were looking at how do you define and how do you know when kids have asthma when they wheeze early. And when you really look at the literature and what we know about symptoms, often there's tremendous amount of loss of lung function before anybody recognizes that. And when reading about Parkinson's disease, I found the same kind of stuff. At least it looks like from an anatomic standpoint, there's a lot of injury to the area of the brain involved with Parkinson's disease before we ever know that that's happened. And what do we know about that in particular?
Well, that's very true with Parkinson's disease. The area of the brain is located in the midbrain, and it's called the locus coeruleus, as well as the substantia nigra. These are areas that secrete dopamine and, to a lesser extent, norepinephrine. Usually, the loss of dopamine or the neurons that secrete dopamine has already occurred to 60 or 70% before anyone becomes symptomatic. So the process has undoubtedly been going on for years. And in fact, in autopsy studies, people who clearly have Parkinson's disease, depending on how progressive it was, you can see an extraordinary degree of loss of the neurons that secrete dopamine. And in other patients who have died from other causes with minimal Parkinson's disease or no symptoms, you might find to a lesser extent the loss of those neurons.
Hmm. Kind of makes me think about when we've done studies on back pain and so forth. You can look at MRIs of people with back pain, and some of them have horrible MRIs that have the patient has no pain, and other people have horrible right. pain and MRIs that aren't distinguishable. It's like, how come we can't tell? And I guess the answer is it's a lot of this stuff is on a molecular basis and smaller. And
Parkinson's disease, very much that's the case. These are very small areas, a centimeter across in the brain, with not that extensive of a cellular network, and there's just no manifestations short of the symptoms that they develop.
Well, while we're on this, a couple of questions come to my mind. One is there's lots of people out there that have a little bit of a tremor, and maybe they have a little bit of tremor more on one side of it. What is it about tremor would bother you as a neurologist?
All tremors bother me, of course. as far as Parkinson's disease go, the distinction is at least very early on and for several years into Parkinson's disease, the tremor is unilateral, just on one side of the body. It's also a resting tremor when someone's sitting still, relaxing, you see the tremor. When they reach out for a glass of water or a pen, early in the disease, the tremor goes away and their dexterity isn't impaired to a significant degree. On the other hand, there's other tremors that are on both sides of the body and only visible when someone is active or using their arms, and that's reassuring against Parkinson's disease. That's likely a different process.
Mm-hmm. And other, again, let's concentrate on the person who's listening out there who's got a little bit of a tremor. What are other maybe more common reasons for tremor or ways you might distinguish tremor from Parkinson's?
From Parkinson's disease. Again, it's the activity-related tremors that probably aren't Parkinson's disease, especially if it's seen on both sides of the body.
Okay.
So the person who should really be worried about Parkinson's disease is someone who has a tremor in left or right arm only and only when the arm is at rest. The patient who reaches out with both arms and there's a tremor as they're trying to hold their arm still, that's likely a different tremor and perhaps something called essential tremor.
I remember when I was in college, my organic chemistry professor had this very tiny, tiny writing, and I later learned he had Parkinson's disease, and you've mentioned that as a common symptom. Why does that happen?
Well, it's called micrographia. fancy word for small handwriting. It's a combination of things. Tremoring could be playing some role in there, but it's also a muscle control issue where your coordination is impaired. Again, this won't be one of the very first symptoms that a patient would experience, but it would be present as time goes on. It's likely due to increased muscle tone in their arms and loss of fine motor control, again, in that arm. And it is, again, relatable to the loss of the dopamine-secreting neurons.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Frank Ellenson. We're discussing Parkinson's disease. Dr. Ellenson is a local neurologist. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. We're going to be on for about the next hour. A local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. A toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us right now if you want to, and if you get it to us in the next hour, we'll try to go through your questions at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. And also remember, if you want to listen to this later, it repeats, it's between 7 and 8, and you can refer anybody you want to kska.org, its website. Tell them to go to line 1, and they can listen to this program at any time in the future, and you can also subscribe to it at the same time if you would like. What about this rigidity that is described? What do we mean by that?
We mean increased passive muscle tone. Patients frequently can also notice when they're trying to move one arm, it seems more stiff. When they're trying to do fine motor movements, open jars, do buttons or zippers, one hand may seem more agile than the other. That's probably the same. What I should say is the side that seems more difficult is the same side you'll find the tremor. The passive movement is when you allow someone else to manipulate your arm and turn it, twist it, and bend it. Then you will notice usually, again, a stiffness to the arm, even a rigidity, a ratchety kind of feeling that can be seen. And usually, again, it's more on one side than the other.
Hmm. All right. We actually have a caller that's calling in with a question. Why don't we go ahead and see if we've got her on the air. Florence, you with us? Florence,
yeah.
What can we do for you?
I'm calling because I heard that the tremors could be on one side, but I'm wondering if it's one or the other. Your left side would go for a little bit, and then...
Will it alternate from one side to the other? Is that typical of Parkinson's disease? Is that your question?
Yes, sir.
Okay, dope. Let's ask.
Well, that isn't typical of Parkinson's disease, at least initially. Sometimes as Parkinson's disease advances, tremoring can be seen in both arms. That would usually be years into the process. And again, it would be seen more when the arm is relaxed and resting, say, sitting on an armrest, than reaching out and trying to use the arm.
So like using a cup of coffee or drinking a cup of coffee would not be characteristic of it to get worse.
Early on in the disease, correct.
And would not usually alternate between.
Correct.
But in later stages, that might happen.
In later stages, certainly tremor is seen in both sides of the body. Again, it shouldn't alternate either. If it's Parkinson's disease, it should always be there when the arm is resting, or it shouldn't. This isn't 100% the case. Sometimes tremors do seem worse at different times of the day. Anxiety, nervousness, certain medications can certainly bring it out more. But it wouldn't alternate and be on the right side one day and the left side on the next day. That would be somewhat unusual.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You bet. Are there other things that we haven't talked about symptoms now that we need to mention? Because my next line of thought in my mind is, well, why are these things happening? I want to get down into what's going on in the nervous system.
Well, we talked about a lot of the secondary symptoms. The major ones, again, are gait instability, tremor, increased muscle tone, and loss of postural balance reflexes. And then we get into more of the what are called autonomic nervous system kind of symptoms, hypotension or loss of regulation of blood pressure, which can cause people to feel lightheaded when they stand up, loss of erectile dysfunction or loss of control, even urinary incontinence to some degree. These are also effects on the nervous system, but this time in the autonomic, the sort of automatic nervous system that we don't have control over these kind of things. And again, it's a loss of the dopamine secretion that is likely playing a big part in that.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I came on the air, I was just looking through some of my notes, and there was an article in the New York Times looking at depression and emotional issues. And, of course, that's a very confounding thing. Anytime anybody's sick, they increase their likelihood. But
right.
Could depression also be part of this illness, or should we think of it as a possibility?
Depression could be a very comorbid condition. A lot of things, and that's also true with Parkinson's disease. Depression increases as we age, too, the likelihood of it.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly it's seen in upwards of 30% of people with Parkinson's disease. So it's certainly something to be cognizant of, usually not a warning sign for Parkinson's disease, but something that's frequently there in patients. One other thing that might be worth mentioning is something called REM, R-E-M, sleep behavior mm-hmm. disorder. This is a sleep disorder, which are called parasomnias. It's characterized by very active dreams. Someone who frequently dreams about being chased or hunted or just frightening dreams, and their bed partner might notice that they're very active and move around in their dreams. Typically, when we sleep and dream, our body is actually paralyzed. It's a natural protective mechanism. But in REM sleep behavior disorder, that disinhibition to prevent you from moving is lost, and you thrash around and sometimes become violent as you're fearful during your dreams, and bed partners have been injured. Hmm. People have also gotten out of bed and injured themselves, thinking that they were wrestling with a bear or a stranger, and they're fighting with their dresser or their door. And some people have gone so far as to have to sort of belt themselves into bed so they don't get out and hurt themselves. But thankfully, with research, there's been pretty good evidence that a simple dose of clonopin, mm-hmm. benzodiazepine, can mm-hmm. really reduce the occurrence of REM behavior disorder mm-hmm. And save a lot of people a lot of poor night's sleep, fear, and even injury.
Okay. We have a couple of emails and also a phone caller, and the caller wants to talk about some medication, but I'm going to have him hold on for a second because I can't help but be impressed by Diane's email. It seems like vitamin D is everywhere. Everybody's worried about vitamin D. Some of the illnesses like multiple sclerosis may have a predilection to be more common the further away you get from the equator. 90% of our vitamin D comes from sunlight. So here's her question. With all the recent news about vitamin D, and how it impacts other diseases, please give us your view on that. I understand that the further we are from the equator one lives, the more frequent Parkinson's disease is. Or am I confusing multiple sclerosis? I didn't read her note all the way. At any rate, please tell us what you think about vitamin D and its relationship, at least to Parkinson's disease.
No, absolutely. I think you might be confusing multiple sclerosis with the relationship from the distance from the equator, which has been pretty clearly established. There isn't the same relationship with Parkinson's disease, as far as I'm aware now. Vitamin D hasn't been extensively studied with Parkinson's disease, either as a treatment or as a deficiency state. It doesn't seem to fit with the pathology of Parkinson's disease, which is due to a neuronal injury thought to be due to something called oxidative stress. So I don't believe vitamin D has a great role in there. Time may prove me wrong on that. And so at this point, I don't recommend vitamin D as a therapy for Parkinson's disease.
She also asked how much should you take, and I've been reviewing this for another talk. I'm going to give them 1,000 to 200, 2,000 international units per day have been recommended for adults. It seems like a safe dose. You'd have to take a heck of a lot of vitamin D to get into trouble, but you can do that. You can take too much water, so be careful. But 1,000 to 2,000 international units per day is one that's often recommended for adults. Let's go ahead and take George on line four. George, what can we do for you?
Hi, thanks for taking the call. My wife suffered an aneurysm in the front of her brain. She had unbelievable tremors, like a whole body. She's taking Topamex now. Is there a potential for that no longer to be effective? Or I know this may not be your subject area, but I was thinking, is it potentially that she'd have to take some other drug to keep the tremors away?
Well, that is possible. I'm certainly not sure what the cause of her tremors are at this point. It could have been that she had seizures at some point secondary to the ruptured aneurysm, which happens. Mm-hmm. Brain injuries can also cause weakness or tremors on the opposite side of the body. It doesn't sound, and I don't think you were asking if this is Parkinson's disease. If Topamax is working for the time being, I think that's a good therapy to continue. If at some time it seems to wear off or escalating dosages don't seem to hold the tremors down, then certainly there are many medications which can be used to treat tremors depending on their cause.
Okay. And the other problem we had was finding a doctor here once we came back from Seattle. Is there a directory or something out there that we can check to find a neurologist?
Yes, I think there are lots of different ways. I've always used Google when I'm looking for doctors in Anchorage, and that seems to be a pretty good way to go.
We were talking before we came on the L, George, that there are many communities of our size across this country are neurologists are not abundantly available. Dr. Ellenson has been here about a year and might be easier to get into. I'll offer that, even though he probably didn't feel comfortable doing that. So, but there are other neurologists in town using the method he suggested.
All right. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You bet. Have a good day. Another email, this one asks about alternative therapies. What do we know about the role of any alternative therapy? The emailer mentions healing touch, herbs, and so forth. What role might they play? What do we know about their effectiveness in alleviating the symptoms of Parkinson's disease?
Sure. This is a topic close to my heart, actually. What I will say is there's been no clearly established benefits to any alternative therapies for Parkinson's disease. Sadly, I've come across some therapies which I think are potentially dangerous through the internet, and most frequently these websites offer a great deal of hope, in fact, a possibility of a cure. Some have even recommended having invasive metaports placed for patients to inject themselves with medications on a daily basis. The trouble with most of these websites is you'll find all sorts of testimonials and case reports where people will say that they've been cured or their symptoms are significantly ameliorated. However, there's a complete and utter lack of evidence behind them, no controlled studies and certainly no peer-reviewed journal articles. I've had this discussion with many people, patients and healthcare providers. Was discussing this with a resident in the family practice program today, and he said that complementary alternative medicines probably aren't harmful, so if someone opts for it, that's fine. And that's frequently true on an individual-by-individual basis, just so long as you are aware of what medications you're taking and what therapies are being offered. But things, some of these therapies have been shown to be dangerous, sometimes even fatal. So I do offer or suggest great caution with these therapies. And I've also known people to avoid treatable conditions trying these therapies and get themselves into more trouble than they were to begin with. So unfortunately, I don't have a great deal of hope for these therapies in Parkinson's disease. There was at least one pretty good study of a coenzyme Q10, which is a vitamin supplement. And at very large dosages, currently the American Academy of Neurology's recommendation is that they can't suggest that it's helpful or harmful at this point. But that's sort of where the case stands now.
Why don't we take a second and talk about alternative health care. I think it's an important issue, and we're going to be doing a program in about a month about a recent book that's reviewed most of the current what we know about this. But, you know, one of the observations I think many people have noticed is that medicine has made tremendous advances. It continues to ask what it's doing is it safe and effective? And it obviously changes as we learn new things. Alternative health care often has not made much change because it's not looking at what they're doing. There's not a lot of science there. Now I'm forgetting my doggone point. I was going to make a point about where that's taken us. We
I could make a point.
Okay.
There's two things I like to point out, and usually if you look for where the profit motive is, you might find some information there. And one thing I point out is that dentists recommend fluoride almost uniformly, and this cuts down on dental cavities 60-70% in some estimates. Those dentists would be performing far more procedures and making a whole lot more money if they weren't recommending the fluoride. So to me, that says that it's against their own profit motive. And probably is a good therapy. A different kind of example is that this country has spent hundreds of millions of dollars in the last 10 years at the National Institute of Health researching complementary and alternative medicines. And during all that research, which has been done in a scientific method, there has not been a single recommended change to the practice of medicine. Not a single new therapy or benefit has been found from these. And most interestingly, practitioners of complementary and alternative medicine have not changed a single one of their methods despite the overwhelming lack of efficacy of their therapies.
Right. And I think that's a very good point and one I have made before. And I did remember what I wanted to say is it's because medicine still, despite all the money that's been spent, we're not very good at curing things. We've certainly made people better. But those things that can be cured are relatively not attached or not attacked by or treated by alternative health care. You don't see any alternative ways to set bones.
Right.
You know, and do appendicitis surgeries and so forth. You see it for multiple sclerosis. You see it for cancer. You see it for the common cold. You see it for Parkinson's disease. And so when a patient feels or is told that we don't have a cure, they're a little bit more apt to be going to try things. You need to keep asking yourself, what's the risk and what's the benefit of treatment as well as not taking the treatment? And so if you think about it like that, your family practice residents who said there's no risk, well, a lot of people substitute alternative care and don't pursue a reasonable treatment that's been shown to be relatively safer and more effective than doing nothing. And a consequence of going after something that has none of those risks or have risk and benefits.
Exactly.
So there's a loss of maybe time and helping some control some disease. All right, so let's get back to Parkinson's disease after this little minor tirade of mine. But what happens in the brain that leads to these symptoms that we've been talking about? Help us understand what the substantia nigra and dopamine and so forth all have to do with this.
This is largely a motor or a muscle control kind of system. It's not the nerves that allow you to flex your bicep or walk. It's the supplementary or it's called extrapyramidal system. The pyramidal system is the system that allows us to have muscle power, whereas the extrapyramidal is sort of a feedback loop to make sure that we're not having too much power or too little power to assure that the agonist muscles or the muscles doing the work are active, whereas the antagonist muscles, the muscles that have to relax for you to flex your arm, are relaxed. And there's an extensive feedback cycle through the deep structures of the brain called the basal ganglia. When dopamine is depleted from the substantia nigra, that feedback cycle changes and does cause loss of motor control, does cause increase in muscle tone and the tremors that we see. So this is a system of helping to coordinate and modulate motor movements that's lost. It doesn't truly affect the nerves themselves that help the muscles move, but it's a management system, if you will.
So let me feedback what I just heard you say. If I reach my hand up to scratch my nose, I flex some muscles in the front of my arm to help me get up there. And at the same time, I'm relaxing muscles on the other side of my arm, the back part. And this area of the brain that helps us involuntarily control all this is not under our thought process.
Correct.
Is going through some disease process and in particular affecting the neurotransmitters in that part of the brain of which dopamine and norepinephrine are part of.
Right. And the dopamine is lost the level of dopamine is much more depleted, which of course allows us to target therapy, which we could talk about later on. But yeah, it's a feedback kind of control mechanism for our movements as opposed to the actual motor movements or the neurons controlling the power of our muscles.
So is this problem localized to these very small areas, junction boxes, so to speak, in the brain where dopamine is a problem, or is it throughout the brain in lesser area, lesser effects where there's more also dopamine being produced?
Right. And used? Well, that's a good question. The area that's most obviously abnormal in a Parkinson's disease patient is the substantia nigra, the area where the dopamine is being produced. We see these pathological findings called Lewy bodies, these intracellular inclusions that are made up of a chemical called alpha-synuclein, which, by the way, we only understand a very little bit about its function. These are accumulated in these Lewy bodies, which lead to cell death. They're seen to a great extent in the substantia nigra, but also frequently seen throughout the brain, not always in a proportion you might expect based on the patient's symptoms. Notably, you can see Lewy bodies in people who have aged without Parkinson's disease, but typically much higher in Parkinson's disease patients.
All right. So the logical question, or at least to me the next question is, well, what's happening? Why is dopamine's function, and why are these Lewy bodies being produced? What do we know about that?
Well, again, these Lewy bodies are a collection of a chemical called alpha-synuclein, which are in Parkinson's patients, accumulating at a rate that's abnormal and that is leading to the death of the cells that secrete dopamine. We believe that alpha-synuclein has a role in communications between one neuron and the next neuron. There's some genetic causes, or I should say, well, genetic Parkinson's causes, which have been mapped to genes controlling alpha-synuclein, and people are actually, in that case, producing an abnormal level, an abnormal chemical form of alpha-synuclein. So that's clearly involved in the pathological process. The future might be to try to control that in the patients who have that gene abnormality, to try to fix that through some sort of gene therapy, or for the more common Parkinson's patient who doesn't have an abnormal gene, to wonder if preventing the accumulation of those alpha-synuclein proteins might be beneficial in preventing Parkinson's disease.
Let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1. My guest today is Dr. Frank Allinson, a local neurologist, and our topic is Parkinson's disease. We've been talking about some of the symptoms and why those symptoms occur and answering a few questions. So if you've got one, here's some phone numbers, 550-8433. If you're local and would like to ask a question about Parkinson's disease, 550-8433. Toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, or you can email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Remember also, if you're listening between 7 and 8, you're listening to a tape rebroadcast, and there's no way we can answer questions at that time. So this is the time to do it, or you can listen to the program later tonight or at any time by going to kska.org and finding Line 1 and listening to this program. Let's see. I'm losing my mind as I get older and trying to remember some of the questions I had. There's also something called secondary Parkinson's disease. I guess we ought to at least mention that. What do we mean by that?
Well, I think the big distinction is Parkinson's disease versus Parkinsonism. Parkinson's disease is the things we talked about. It's probably more apt to refer to it as idiopathic Parkinson's disease. And again, that's the patient with a tremor on one side of the body, stiffness on one side of the body, and the changes in gait or walking that are pretty typically seen. Parkinsonism are symptoms similar. The tremor may not be as obvious. The symptoms are frequently seen on both sides of the body. And it's important to distinguish the two. Parkinsonism can be seen after the use of neuroleptic medications, antipsychotic medications, or even anti-nausea medication. So that's something to keep in mind. Is the person on or have they been exposed to any of those medications? Secondarily, there's a group of diseases that are sometimes referred to as Parkinson plus syndromes. These are symptoms where the patient looks Parkinsonian. It's another way of saying that they might have Parkinson's disease or at least Parkinsonism. But they're more apt to have other more serious problems like frequent hallucinations, alterations in their level of consciousness at times, waning from a completely normal, awake, and lucid to unarousable. Patients may also have significant problems with blood pressure control, more so than seen in typical Parkinson's disease, and they can have trouble with eyes as far as double vision and loss of ability to open or close their eyes, and in worst cases, and falls can be a very profound problem. So it is important to make sure that it's decided whether this is a Parkinsonism or Parkinson's disease, and then the appropriate treatments can be attempted.
Okay. We have a caller and another email, and I'm going to take the email. Both of these are getting a little bit into treatment and progression. This is an email from Allison, and I'm going to read it. There's a number of issues here, but it also is important to recognize that her husband was diagnosed at Oregon Health Sciences in the year 2000. You may have been around there at that point. She wonders about progression. He wonders how long and what's next, and can you even predict that? Her husband was 62, diagnosed with Parkinson's in the year 2000, had a DBS implanted at Stanford, so in 2005. We left Alaska because of mobility and his diminished point where he couldn't able to walk or take care of his needs very well. He seemed to get very cold when he was outside, had some urinary tract problems. Into no tremor, had rigidity before pills, and it appears to come back if he doesn't take it, so that medications have been affecting that. He's having some pain associated with some neuropathies, had to have a pacemaker, has some of the nighttime issues that you were discussing, and describes that as severe RLS, and mm-hmm. It's another issue that maybe needs to be brought up. Blood pressure is labile. She's asked a number of questions about natural history, kind of describe this individual's particular course. What are your comments?
Sure. Well, unfortunately, Parkinson's disease does always get worse. A lot of factors play a role in that. Every person is an individual with this disease, as much so as with any neurological disease. It's really difficult to predict, especially over the radio email kind of situation here, what an individual will go through. But as time goes on, things generally do become more difficult. The things that usually are problematic are walking, whether or not the medications are effectively helping your husband walk without falling or significant stiffness. There's a whole bunch of great medications that are available. I'm not sure if it's time to get into those exactly at this moment, but I guess the answer to that first question about progression is it's variable for each individual. There are sometimes Parkinson's disease sometimes is divided into two distinct entities. One is that where there's a tremor that's the most dominant, that's called tremor predominant Parkinson's disease, versus a more bradykinetic, which is a word meaning slowness of movements, a bradykinetic form of Parkinson's disease. And it sounds like that's what your husband has, as he doesn't have much of a tremor. I agree that Alaska might not be the greatest place for someone with a gait disorder to be walking around 6 months out of the year. So those conditions, usually medications are more effective at treating the bradykinetic or the slow movements than they are in treating the tremor, but that's not always true. And it might just be a matter of finding the right medications. The DBS might be something worth noting here. That means deep brain stimulator. Over the course of years, it was discovered that either placing a lesion, which is a fancy way of saying surgically injuring a portion of the brain, or implanting a electrical device which emits electrical activity, might be ways to treat Parkinson's disease. So DBS is currently the most favored way. The electrode is typically placed in a nucleus called the subthalamic nucleus, and it stimulates the nucleus, effectively reducing its role. And the patients very frequently are able to significantly reduce the amount of medication they have, it might have a very significant response both in tremoring and in walking.
And one final question that she asks is, even with all he has had done, is it really PD? Is it really Parkinson's disease? Which to me is a reflection of the frustration of two things. One, no cure. Two, the inevitable worsening that this disease, like many diseases, have. And no gold standard diagnostic thing. It's not like we can absolutely guarantee you this is one of those clinical diagnoses.
It is a clinical diagnosis, but I would say that autopsy studies compared to the diagnosis with a neurologist probably would be over 85 to 90%. And typically the difference would be, is this a Parkinson's disease, an idiopathic Parkinson's disease versus a Parkinson plus syndrome? Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's tricky. Mm-hmm. I would certainly hope for this individual patient, after having a deep brain stimulator placed at a major university like that, that there was little equivocation about the diagnosis. So I do believe that it's very likely to be Parkinson's disease.
What you're saying is it's not likely people are going to be doing that kind of surgery without some very good evidence, and maybe not the greatest reassurance, but this sounds like it most likely was.
Especially at a major university like that, yeah.
Yep. Okay. Which brings up a question in my mind is thinking about Parkinson's disease. Many of us have recognized that Michael J. Fox has had a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, a younger guy. But then my understanding is Muhammad Ali, the ex-Cassius Clay, had Parkinson's disease. Is Muhammad Ali's Parkinson's disease another problem that has Parkinson-like picture to it? Or does he truly have Parkinson's disease, most likely?
Boy, without being able to evaluate him, I can't say with any certainty. Certainly, he's taken a number of blows to the head, which is associated with an increased risk of Parkinson's disease. There's no way of knowing what he would have been like without boxing, whether or not he would have developed Parkinson's disease. So at this point, I can't be sure. It sure looks like at least a Parkinson's-like syndrome.
Let's take one of the caller we have. Mike, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I've had Parkinson's for a couple of years, and recently they brought some specialists up to do lectures, and they both had suggested physical therapy or Tai Chi, yoga, things like that. What's your guest's opinion on that?
Okay. Good question.
Does he know of anybody that he'd recommend in the Anchorage area for this?
Okay.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Well, being relatively new here, I've just trying to get established with which therapists or specialists in neurological conditions. So I might refrain from making recommendations over the air. But I do agree almost with every patient regarding of your condition, even if you're completely healthy, that physical activity is imperative for some peace of mind or for reason to exercise. That's one of the few things that correlates well with diminishing your risk of Alzheimer's disease. So if that's not enough motivation, I'm not sure what is. But additionally, for Parkinson's disease, conditions that affect balance and walking and that kind of safety issue, maximizing your strength and ability to protect yourself and not fall, I think, is very important. So coordination activities like yoga or Tai Chi or frankly, just walking on a daily basis and doing some appropriate exercises will at the very least increase your muscle strength and flexibility and probably also increase your bone density to prevent injury when you do fall or if you do fall.
As a 60-year-old who is noticing that balance is not as good as it used to and having been chastised at this recent conference about all of us eating too much and not exercising enough, it's probably a good idea for all of us to get out and move around a little bit more.
On a daily basis, yeah.
I think it is fair to say if you practice balance activities as you get older, you're less likely to lose that balance. I don't want to say something wrong.
I think that's true.
Okay. Have another email, this one chastising us a little bit about what we had to say, but very politely. It says, when you were discussing the alternative treatment, the point was made that profit is not generated by dentists in some of their treatments. If I understand you, you're saying that there isn't a profit in the medical-related studies, What about the huge profits by drug companies and the AMA? I'm not sure the AMA makes a lot of money, but some alternative treatments are good for some things. Acupuncture has been used in pain therapy and surgeries instead of narcotics and putting a patient completely out, for example, and it has been practiced for a few hundred years. If I misunderstand your point, she apologizes. So what's your comment?
I appreciate the good drugs that are provided by pharmaceutical companies. I'm not a big fan of the cost of those drugs, especially for my patients who can't get them and have to settle for a lesser drug or one with more toxic side effects. So I'm not a don't want to bite any hands here, but I'm not a I have no stock in pharmaceutical companies, and I appreciate their good products when they work. What I would say, at least about those drugs, is they're trusted against placebos by and large when it's safe and appropriate to do so. And so we have some good evidence to say that they're safe and effective. What I'll say about acupuncture is I think there's an extreme lack of controlled studies to show that acupuncture has been more effective than placebo in treating pain, headaches, anesthesia, or almost any condition.
There is... Again, we're going to do a program on all of the, many of the alternative treatments by a person who has independently decided to look into the research on these things. The book is called Trick or Treatment, and the second chapter is extensive review of all the information we know about acupuncture. And I think there's a tremendous amount of misunderstanding originating back when Nixon first went to China, and there were pictures of people getting surgery under acupuncture alone, apparently, which was not true. It's just been blown way out of proportion.
That's my understanding as well.
Okay, another caller. Pete, you're on line one.
Hi there. I want to let people know that there is a Parkinson's support group here in town. We meet every third Saturday of the month at 1 o'clock at the Anchorage Senior Center, and we sort of share tips about our own particular cases, and we have speakers. And there's also going to be an event November 18th where the American Parkinson's Disease Association will be bringing up a movement disorder specialist, and that's, I'm sorry, November 18th, and that will be at Alaska Regional. And if people want more information, they can call 346-3776.
346-3776. Okay, thanks very much, Frank. Or Pete, sorry.
Yeah, I have one more thing I'd just
sure.
like to tell you about, which is I think that exercise is not only good for preserving your ability to move, et cetera, but it looks like it may have some neuroprotective effect as well.
Yep. Yep. Even maybe with dementia, some of the studies are coming out. Again, I don't want to get too crazy. We want to be able to document what we say, but that's where things look like they're moving. And then,
well, I think
and
that...
Could I have your email, I guess, and I'll email the information about the group.
Email it at line1 at ksk.org, okay?
That's line one, all
yeah,
spelled out, or line one
yeah,
with eight.
Yeah, but no dots. I mean, just line1 at ksk.org.
Sounds good. Thanks.
You bet.
I think just a quick comment to make sure we are stating things that we know and not that we don't. I think exercise can benefit people and help them regain skills that may have been lost and functionally do better than just preventing loss of motor control. But I don't know that if we can't say neuroprotective benefit in the sense that it's helping support the neurons that are being injured in that condition.
In
Parkinson's disease specifically.
I know of
no evidence that suggests exercise will reduce the rate of loss of neurons in the substantia nigra.
Okay.
But
All
it can
right.
be very beneficial.
All right. We have a number of emails, and I am not going to be able to get to all of them, and I want to make sure we talk about just the overview of treatment. So let's do that, and then we'll see what time we've got left. We've got, about 7 minutes or so.
Well, there is a gold standard for treatment, and that's a drug called Sinemet. It's a combination of a drug called carbidopa and levodopa, or L-DOPA. That medication was discovered in the 60s, and if you want to see a movie that might bring that out a little bit, it's called Awakenings. I think it had Robert De Niro and Robin Williams in that, and I think that was an Oliver Sacks novel. He's an English neurologist. That when that drug was discovered, it was a monumental leap in the treatment of Parkinson's disease, taking disabled, bedridden patients who certainly would have perished, would have died in short order, and allowed them to be much more functional. That medication is still the best. It's going on 50 years now, but it's still the best treatment available. There are side effects with that medication. Most are fairly minimal: nausea, lightheadedness, reducing blood pressure, which sometimes is okay, as a lot of patients also have hypertension. The one thing that should be stressed about Sinemet, it's not always the best first drug for Parkinson's disease. Most patients who take Sinemet for 5 or 10 years will develop side effects from that are very obvious. Michael J. Fox is the best example of that. His kind of moving, shaking, and I shouldn't use the word shake, but his movements where he seems to rock back and forth, and almost snake-like movements, those are called dyskinesias. And those are somewhat unique to patients with Parkinson's disease who take Sinemet for at least several years. That situation is difficult to treat. There's a few medications which might reduce those dyskinesias, and deep brain stimulation seems to be very helpful for that. The trouble is that if we place someone who's 50 on Sinemet for Parkinson's disease, they likely have 25 to 30 years left to live and very likely will develop dyskinesias, which then are another condition that needs treatment. So initially, if you can avoid starting Sinemet, it might be best to try some of the other medications. Another thing with regards to treatment is that tremoring sometimes is pretty refractory to Sinemet. Some people do really well with it. Other people take Sinemet, feel great, their walking's improved, their balance is better, their muscle tone is normal, but their tremoring just won't go away. And frequently then using medications that are more specific for the tremoring can be beneficial. So a patient new to the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, suffering largely only from tremor, might be better served to try to treat the tremor first, wait for the disease to progress before starting Sinemet. Now, there's several other classes of medications, something called a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. This prevents the degradation of dopamine, prolonging its effect in the brain. These medications have now been thought to slow the progression of Parkinson's disease. The studies aren't overwhelming. It's difficult to interpret the data because these medications also help with the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. So it's trying to be sorted out whether or not the progression is being slowed or if we're just seeing patients are getting better because they're taking the medication. In any case, those medications are usually well-tolerated, once daily dosage, so they're very convenient and easy to take, and it might be worthwhile to use one of those medications early on, especially if it does turn out that they're able to prevent the progression. And one last large class of drugs are called dopamine agonists. These are chemicals that look similar enough to dopamine that they could actually bind at the receptor sites for dopamine and sort of, if you will, trick the brain or the nerves into believing there's more dopamine around than actually is. So that's a whole other class of medications which can be very helpful and might be a reasonable thing to start before Sinemet is used, and maybe even an addition to Sinemet as years go by.
I want to try to move on to a couple more emails, but I think the overriding message I'm getting is this is a very complex and evolving treatment. And like any treatment, there's risks and benefits, and it really takes some experience and knowledge about what you're doing, particularly with the medications. The obvious question is, how effective overall are our current medications in managing these people? We understand we're not going to cure it. Have there been great leaps forward? You mentioned once we realized that we could affect it with L-DOPA, that was a big leap. But where are we going, or how effective are we?
Well, I would say for at least several years, 5 to 10 years maybe, in the disease, that most patients can get by very well with little limitation in their lives. And of course, it's easy for me to say that I don't have the disease. Mm-hmm. So patients out there, please forgive me. On the other hand, the disease does progress. There is a limitation to the benefits of these medications. So after having the disease for 10 or 15 or 20 years, likely there will be as side effects from the medications and the disease will have progressed so that the symptoms aren't as well treated. Patients in that situation, I frequently do recommend evaluation for deep brain stimulator placement. So I will send them to California or Portland or Seattle for consideration for that.
We really are not going to have much time left. There's only about 2 to 3 minutes, but one of the emailers asked about dropped head syndrome. What is that? Is that characteristic part of perhaps later Parkinson's disease?
That's a great question. It can have many, many causes. It can be seen in Parkinson's disease, but maybe not for quite the same reasons. Posture tends to change. If you've seen an elderly man with Parkinson's disease, typically you see him shuffling with his head facing directly down to the ground, and his posture almost looks like a bit of a question mark as he walks. So that might be the reference being made. Certainly the muscles of the neck can become fatigued and rigid and affected by Parkinson's disease, but there's many other neurological conditions and muscle conditions which can cause this dropped head syndrome, including myasthenia gravis or a primary muscle disorder. So it can be seen in Parkinson's disease, but maybe for different reasons than the other conditions.
Okay. We've only got a minute or two. I guess I always like to sum up as best we can. What's the important bits of information we need to leave in the next minute or so?
Probably making sure that the diagnosis is accurate would be one. I frequently have seen patients who are older, don't walk so well, and have a little bit of a tremor, and that's not always Parkinson's disease, and taking medications for a condition you don't have would be important to avoid. So figuring out the diagnosis exactly, and then making sure that the appropriate treatments have been tried and in the right order, I think makes a difference for Parkinson's disease.
Let me also remind our listeners who we did not get to their questions or emails. If you go to our website, there's a couple of good links to further information. And I want to express my thanks to today's guest, Anchorage neurologist Dr. Frank Ellenson. It's been a real pleasure, and I appreciate your taking the time.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Next week, as you might expect, we're going to be back and changing tune a little bit. We're going to be talking about birth choices, what's available, what do we know about each of those, again, looking at risks and benefits, and we're going to be doing that with Anchorage midwife Barbara Norton. So tune into your health and learn more Monday, September 22nd at 2 p.m. And remember also, we repeat each Monday evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line One, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line One, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.